Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming this evening. As you know, this is the first event that's being held in conjunction with the exhibition Color Chart, Reinventing Color, 1950 through today, which I, Ann Temkin, have organized and opened a couple of weeks ago here at the museum. Our program tonight is one in which we are amazingly fortunate to be able to present three distinguished and incredibly interesting speakers, both as artists, as idea makers, and as conversationalists. So although this looks a little official here with these tables and microphones, really what the evening has been designed as is a conversation among myself, the art critic and art historian Bernard Marcadet, and the artists John Baldessari and Daniel Buren. The title, Color and Conceptualism, is intended about as a question as much of as a statement, and that's something that we'll all get into together. The format of the evening will be a brief conversation from the three speakers, a brief introduction to their work, or in Bernard's case, finally, some kind of ideas to throw out to begin a discussion, and then the four of us will set up here, talk amongst ourselves for a while, and then open the discussion up to everybody in the audience to make it a very, perhaps, conceptual conversation. The background of everybody I will just give you ever so briefly. John Baldessari, who will be presenting first, was born in 1931 in National City, California. As most of you know, he has been one of the most highly esteemed teachers of all our contemporary artists in America, having taught at the California Institute of the Arts at Valencia from 1970 to 1988, and at UCLA from 1996 up until just last year. And I have a feeling we couldn't have gotten him to be here tonight if that was not not ongoing anymore. I loved the bio that we got sent from his studio. All I can tell you is that there are more than 200 solo exhibitions and 750 group exhibitions that he has participated in the last 30-some years. I am not going to even begin to list those. You'll be glad to know. He has many awards, including an Americans for the Arts Lifetime Achievement Award and a California Governor's Lifetime Achievement in the Visual Arts Award. Many, many honorary degrees, including here in New York, one from Parsons. The best opportunity to get a broad idea of the span of his work will come next year when a touring retrospective starting at Tate Modern in London will take place. Daniel Buren, representing perhaps the European side of conceptualism, evolving simultaneously to that in the United States, was born outside Paris in 1938. He studied painting and what we might think of as more conventional art as well, but then in September 1965 began using the striped canvas that we know as Americans most easily from the cafe awnings in Paris as his medium for his work, and in the 43 years since that time has stretched that vocabulary in ways certainly, I think, foreseeable even to him at that initial point. He, too, I could number exhibitions in the hundreds, and certainly insofar as in situ installations go, in the thousands. There are certain permanent ones as well, though, that you're probably familiar with, perhaps most famously Les Deux Plateaux at the Palais Royal in Paris that went up 20 years ago now. Also, plenty of awards to his name. In 1986, the Golden Lion for his pavilion at the Venice Biennale, and then just last year, for example, the Premium Imperial from Japan. Finally, Bernard Marcadet, here from Paris, an art historian and critic who's written many books since 1986, but most recently, departing from his more theoretical, philosophical, art critical position, wrote an outstanding, incredibly well-received biography of Marcel Duchamp that Flammarion published last year and that we're hoping we'll see in an English translation very soon. He's also been very active as an independent curator, and his shows, perhaps most closely relating to color and conceptualism, are, well, just taking an example, Feminine Masculin, Le Sexe de l'Art, in 1995 at the Centre Pompidou. He's curated biennials such as, or French participation in biennials such as that of Sao Paulo in 1991 and in Gwangju in 1997. And just most recently at the Triennale in Paris called La Force de l'Art at the Grand Palais in 2006. Obviously, or I guess perhaps not so obviously, Daniel Buren and John Baldessari are both artists in among the 44 artists represented in Color Chart. Daniel Buren, as he has done a couple of times in the past, one in an exhibition curated by Bernard Marcadet in Paris, not given us a work of art that you can look at the wall, but instead the vests that all of the security guards, not only in the exhibition, but throughout the museum are wearing, are his fantastic striped fabric printed in Lyon, France, and then made by the same company who makes our normal guard uniforms here in Virginia. John Baldessari is in the exhibition with the photograph Seven Common Memory Colors and the film Six Colorful Inside Jobs, which I was pleased to tell him about today. People actually stand watching because it's projected high in the space of the gallery. And when the painter is done with his six rounds of painting a room a different color, the people gathered actually on many occasions have actually all applauded, which was a surprise to all of us. So with some more applause, we welcome John Baldessari. And thank you again.
God, this is not... I'm too tall for the mic. I wanted to begin. I have to make this really short, I guess. Of some epiphanies I had about color. I started out as a painter, and sort of segued into photography and painting again. But I was doing a whole series, and it'll be here in the images, of photographing colors of cars. And trying to go through the color wheel, you know, primaries and secondaries, and I can never find cars that were painted purple. Custom colored cars, like in East LA, yeah, no problem, purple cars. But you know, off the assembly line, really a difficult problem. And I was having a show at the time. This was in the mid '70s with Jim Corcoran, who became a part of. C&M Arts, yeah, right. And mentioned it to him, and Jim, why are there no purple cars? And he it wasn't an issue for him. He said, well, every dealer knows this, that any painting that has purple in it, you have to sell it 10% at least less, because people don't like purple. It's a difficult color. And he said, I just stole a Picasso that had purple in it, and I had to reduce the price of it. Simple answer. Okay, then a couple of other epiphanies. One when I was a painting student and trying to paint a still life, and I, for some reason, I wanted to paint red in the lower right-hand corner, but there is no red in the props. And, you know, that dilemma that every artist faces, do I paint what I see or do I paint what I want to paint? So that was the second epiphany. The third one, I told Anne when she was organizing this show that my father was a slumlord and I used to have to paint his apartments. And I really wanted to be painting and not his apartments, but my own paintings. And so I had a mind game as I was painting his wall. I'd say, now I'm painting a wall, now I'm making a painting. Now I'm painting a wall, now I'm making a painting. I said, what's the difference? You know, it's the same activity. You're just putting paint on a surface. And then at the sort of last epiphany, where I really saw color as a problem, was when I got disenchanted with painting. Not that I didn't like painting, but I thought there should be more to art than just painting. And began to do photography, and then got into using color. I was a little reticent because, you know, kind of fugitive at that time, using color. And then I realized, yeah, when you take a color photograph, you have to take the colors that are out there. You can't just make them up. Unless you're an Italian filmmaker and you go out there and paint the streets or whatever. So I really saw it as a problem, and then I began painting on the photograph. So if I didn't like someplace, it's a color, I just changed the color up, you know, just painted it in. Okay, enough of my epiphanies, and I want to show you some work. This is one of the earlier pieces I did using color photography, and very much interested in language, and came across a word, defenestration, which has a very specific meaning. It's throwing things out of a window. And I said, why would we ever need a word to describe that? But there is such a word. So I said, okay, I want to deal with that. And this is my house where I was living. Daniel, you were there years ago. Yeah. And I thought we'd like to throw something out of the window and say, well, you know, it's too realistic. I just big pieces of, you know, colored cardboard. And it decided us to go through the color wheel again, chromatically, from, you know, red, yellow, blue, green, violet, orange. And that was it. And it seemed to hold up for me, and it still does. This is called Simone Eating Fruit, and I was trying the sensitivity of color film, and you, for some reason, got into flowers and couldn't find any blue flowers. So in a movie, I just made a white flower blue, so I would have a blue flower. Then the symbol is poetry, of course. You know, blue roses are very important. And then fruit, and couldn't find anything blue, so I painted a pear blue, I think, here, so there I could go through all the colors. And it's simply that, just going through the color wheel. This is the one that's in the show. It's called Common Memory Colors. And it's a great title. I wish I had thought it up, but Kodak thought it up. In the 70s or late 60s, when you'd buy color film, there is a little part of the information, technical information, the paragraph is entitled Common Memory Colors. And what is this? And it said that Kodak designed their film so that they would be sensitive to the colors people are most critical of. So flesh color, white, gray, black, sky, and green for anything growing, and what's the last one? Sand, I guess, yeah, sand, gray. I just used their ordering, and would leave my studio each day and pursue that list, and always shot my hand because it was the closest bit of flesh, and then whatever I saw, I think I always headed. I'm living right by the beach, so I always figured I had to end up with gray, and so I'd always head down to the beach to get the gray, and then anything between flesh and sand, you know, I could pick up on the way. I would photograph it. This one, I would, across the street from me, there was a bakery and charcuterie, and cars would park. And I thought, well, this is a good way to sort of get non-aesthetic color. Just wherever the cars park, I'll photograph them in that order. Where there's empty space, that would be an empty parking space. So those are all the cars, their car door is parked on that block. And then I started thinking about color as object, and I said, how can you think of color as an object? So I was photographing just color, and then I decided just to pull the camera back a bit and photograph my thumbs holding down the piece of colored paper so you could see that the color was something, not just color. And this is the movie that's upstairs. It came out of my house painting experience. And I had an opportunity to have be funded to do a movie. So in this gallery, or no, alternative space, we just built a room and had a camera above. And a student of mine would come in every night, and you couldn't see this happen except you could look through a peephole and see it every night if you wanted to stay there all night and watch him paint. And it started out with red and then went through the color wheel. I think it took him, he started about 6 and he usually finished about 10 o'clock at night. But then the film is pixelated, so each, in what you see upstairs, I think it goes, every color is like 5 minutes or maybe less. And so it's very funny, like an old silent film, I guess. He's jumping around, and you never know where he's going to paint next. But I just thought, you know, again, color as painting as activity, color, you know, is following it in sequence. And it wasn't supposed to be seen as art in any way, except a lot of things do look like Rothko, I realize. And very much interested in language in my career. And I've said a few times that an image and a word are sort of equal in my mind. And these are some of my most complicated works, and where I was trying to equate a word with an image. So I was taking, I had a setup where a camera in front of a TV screen. It was with something called an intervalometer, where you could set it to take a photograph at set intervals, like every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes. And I would turn the channel each morning and take the roll in out at the end of night. And so the first ones were black and white images. And, you know, because also, I didn't want to make aesthetic decisions about what was beautiful. And then I started shooting from color movies. And then I said, well, I want single colors. So then I began to use filter on the film. So I would have red photographs, orange photographs, green ones, going through the 6 primary and secondary colors. And then I had an assistant on the back of each photograph. Whatever she thought would be the surrogate word for that image, she would write it down. And then I had these elaborate filing systems of for black and white shots, full color shots, individual color shots, and then all those images were alphabetized. And then I work out sort of language games where then I would have to go to those source materials and say, okay, I need a red image with a word that starts with V. And then I would go and see if I had one, and with luck, I had one. And then I would range these sort of syntactical lines of images. The game is described down below here. This is what happens when you read too much about structuralism. These are more recent. These are all the words I could find for purple. And then I found an image where I thought kind of looked purple, and then making him purple. And then the ones that are circled are the ones I thought came closest to him. And from that, went into the pure color. And these are all words for blue. And then I began, as you all have experienced, names for paints have changed. You know, no longer can, go in. Well, it's art stores you can, but, I mean, any other store you can't. I was just reading in Vanity Fair a bit about Calvin Klein. Somebody said, no, you can't say tan with Calvin Klein. You have to say sand. So these names, I don't know who comes up with them, but so I began to get all of these, you know, from all the paint companies, and then I wouldn't look at the colors. I would just go through the index and find words I liked, and then I would be honor-bound to use the colors that came with them, and quite often they're really surprising, and then I would gang them up, and, you know, they kind of work together. And those are the colors. They're printed in those colors that they are in the color books from the paint companies. I was thinking the other night, you know, I have a piece I'm keeping. It's just a square of green, and the color in the paint catalog is green with envy. Now, what would happen if you went into an art store and said, may I help you? Yes, I like a tube of green with envy. I mean, what color would that be? Nobody would know, of course. And then going into pure color, and these are those colors, and those are the names for those colors. That's a single one. And what I like about this, nobody would know this, you know, I have to, I'll tell people if they're interested, but the painting is over here. This is photographically printed. This is on canvas, and that's lettered by a sign painter on this side. You'd think it'd be printed out. The photographic thing, which this could very well be, is over here, so it's just switched. And that's all I have to say about color. Okay.
So I just pick up some works where, in fact, the idea and the play with color was one of the most important for this selection. Here we have a work done during 6 years, 5 different exhibitions, and you will see immediately. So I don't want to make too much details. Just I did the show in 69, and that was, of course, the exhibition, and that's all. Then invited to make a second show, I thought it was a good idea to work with the color. So the second show was exactly at the same place, on the same building, and a change of color. And like that, we work with the patience of this gallery, which accepts that every year, till the gallery closed, by the way, and change the space. So we have like that a work with colors, a work with memory, the work with time, and also with space. But what and how the color is used, it's as something to read. So in fact, you can remember even very simple, but blue or red or green. So 69, 71, 72, 73, 74. This is another work where, again, the use of the color was really to help to read. The thing was done every night for 1 month in in Burgundy for the regional TV. So every night at around 7 o'clock, the people were watching the news. So the very first day, and we also, I forgot to say that we did not announce anything. So the people looked and get to this image. The second day, so the thing is also working, of course, with a frame, with a TV frame, with what's happening in this box. I realized that to make the full, let's say, the background, I need 6 pieces of paper. So that was the 6 days of the news in the week, 1 day off. And then the second week start with a new color. Like that for the 4 weeks duration. Funny thing, you see the speaker, the woman, she changed the blues with the color. That was... And at the very last day, we have had an interview at the same time, and we explained to the people who really send a lot of letters to say, but what is that? Why the thing changed, etc., etc., and no answer except for the very last day. This is a work which is, as many of my work, working with a space, a specificity of the space, but here, being in a museum, where I work also with, let's say, the color, basic idea of the color, and to do so, I use one of the most famous paintings, which is in the Stedelijk, which is the famous papier collé, papier découpé, from Matisse. So I work with the painting, and what I did was to take the numbers of colors being the same. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but of course they are absolutely not equal. And then I put all the colors by their heaviness, first being the most used, two the second use, third, etc., etc. I think I found 7 different colors. And then working with the architecture, here it's a little... plane of the museum, I worked with the distribution of the color from, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then symmetrical, and in front of the beginning, 1, 2, 3, and there that was already used. So also to make more or less the same proportion. So you can see this one was over 90 times, and then the second one was 10 times, I think, etc., etc. The last one being the orange, only 1 time. I mean, this type of orange. So I use the one of the architecture characteristic of the museum, which are the top angle of each doors, and I did paint a piece of plexiglass, which is directly installed in these little corners. So you certainly saw a picture or know directly this work, Les Deux Plateaux. One thing which is not maybe as visible as the rest is the use of the color. So this piece, which is a permanent piece in the Palais Royal in Paris, is during the day, it's totally black and white, from black to white or white to black. And then at night, start the color. So I use... like a second piece, the work, when you see it at night and when it's working, which is already not the case because they made so much bad maintenance and we have to repair everything. But when it's working, you have a very different work under your eyes. And at night, you have the color. So when you come from one side, all the floor is red. On the other side, you have the floor completely green. And on the trench, where are the water running, everything is blue. following the general grid of the construction. So that's a different use of the color, given, of course, being done with the electricity. This is a simple work which deal directly with color. So you have a series of panels which are white and with mirror stripes. Then I cut the space in five absolutely equal size on the wall. And each of these fives have a different color. So you have five colors, and then the distribution of the panels goes all around the room. And of course, depending the way you walk in this room, the panels change the color. They reflect. And I did a lot of work working with this interesting possibility of the mirror. And of course, the coloring of the piece, it's completely, in a way, virtual. It's what you see, but as soon as you move, it's another color. So, for example, no one of these panels is white and red, or white and green, or white and blue. It's everything is white and mirror. When I use color, the color, like when I use more than two colors, it's always a way how to put this color, where to put it if you have a room or if you have a series of works or whatsoever. And what I do and what I did since the very beginning when I use colors, which is a long time ago, I always made all the colors by the alphabetical order of the country where I do the work, which means also that the same range of color in another country will look very different. This is a work in an old synagogue turned into an art museum or institution, small institution. And I did something very simple. I cut the full architecture into absolute equal space. One you see on the left is totally painted. All the walls, parallels, have the same color, and all the other walls, perpendicular, have another color. So it's only two colors, yellow and blue. The rest of the space, it's completely empty. And there, the only thing which is touch are the windows. So in one way, half of the place, you have the color being applied, like any colored wall. And in the other part of the thing, the color is a projection of the light through the windows. So you have a very different way of playing with the color in the same space. Another work with mirrors and the play with the fact when we move, of course, we don't see the same thing. So the ceiling of this courtyard in the entrance of the museum, it's colored, it's four walls, four colors. And I just built in the room itself a series of desks which are, instead of having photos or documentation, they are just covered with a mirror. So the first thing you can see, because it's closer to your position and to the eyes, are the coloring desk which catch the color which is on top of it. I go fast just to give an idea of a different use when the color is really there. I use also the color in order to read, to make a distinction between, for example, two walls or two objects, or a difference between one object or one piece of the architecture close to you and another one a little further. Just to say that they are never done a priori for an aesthetic reason. And of course, they always end to an aesthetic position. This is a series of work where, in fact, the title itself was dealing directly with the word color. This is done in Bregenz, and each floor of the museum was treated differently. So this one was a series of huge boxes using three different colors and being full of light inside and giving the light of the room. Yellow, red, blue, and black and white stripes. So depending also where you enter into the room, you were having a full mass of red or a full mass of blue, etc. Same museum, another floor, the color multiplied. So in this room, I cover all the walls with mirrors, and I played only with the panels, which are a glass panel, so they are translucent. And I use this material, which in fact catch the light, which is behind. And the colors goes everywhere. The last floor was a combination of many works, which I call usually exploded cabins. And I cover the full room with these cabins of using different material, but they are all having exactly the same size and the same way to be constructed. So here, for example, it's really playing with all the effect you can have with transparency. For example, the green is completely excluded from this construction, but the green happened to be visible in many, many places by the mixture under your eyes, of course, of the blue and yellow. And you have that with all the colors. And to continue in the same city, but that was outside of the museum and for the duration of the summertime, I did a work on the lake, playing with, of course, the walk of the people passing in front of these big panels, each time with the different colors, and I think something like 9 or 11 colors, repeating after 9, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., all along the promenade of the lake. Another way to use the color, in one of the work I did for the show at the Pompidou exhibition, very, very simple, I just give you these images, which was a light projector like you have in the theater, and this is just framed on the wall, and the color is given with the filters on the projector. So it's not very stable, move a little bit with the movement of the building so you can see that it's not painted on the wall. This is done in Japan in a museum which has been built by the same architect who did the building here, Kanazaki. And it's a permanent piece outdoor. I work with three different exploded cabin, and I use three basic colors, blue, yellow, and red. And what I am interested with this type of work, it's the idea to give the color almost in the space, almost floating in the space. And to do that, of course, where you put the color are these big boxes. It's 4 meters by 4 by 4, which are completely covered with mirrors. So, in fact, these boxes disappear in the landscape. Here they disappear with the architecture. They repeat the architecture. And what you see, it's really the jump of the color from it. That's where I did also several works, which in fact are not the directly the color, but in fact the projection of the color. So here it's the entrance of this museum with a kind of a canopy, which is not so extraordinary, as you can see. And I use it completely with the transparent filters. And then what's happening, of course, when the sun happened to be there, it's the fact that during the day, the colors invade the space and goes everywhere with the turn of the earth. Another way to work, more recent, in a private garden. So here we have a series of arches, and we can see either the color in its reflection or the color directly, depending also wherever you work, you walk under these arches. So here we are walking in front of the mirror. And of course, we see what is behind the mirror. We are still in front of the mirror. Again. And now we are in front of the color. And I will finish with this work, which has been done. It's a public piece in Bilbao. And it's really a pure piece of full color, which is on the foot of the Guggenheim Museum. And of course, this form you see, but I don't want to speak about it. It's something I also create on the bridge. The bridge before has not this this shape. So now it's very different. And it's, of course, only one color, but I think it's a mass of color which for me was quite important to play in such a situation with a beautiful cover of the Frangieri architecture, which, as you know, changed with the sun and the sky from morning to evening. The blue is part of the Gary building. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sorry for the image. For the 69 exhibition conception in Leverkusen, Germany, Baldessari wrote, "The world has too much art. I have made too many objects. What to do?" One of his ideas is to collect all the 45 records of pop tunes with a color in the title, Blue Velvet, Mellow Yellow, Deep Purple, etc. Arranged chromatically on a jukebox, one can choose his own colors, composition, etc. Historical conceptual art had a controversial relation to color, and thus, in a way, it renewed the 17th century debates about color. Daniel Buren explained it very well when pointing to the uniformity of white, black, beige hues of Siena, which dominated artistic production and the exhibition of the 60s and 70s. Buren also affirmed that in the exhibition of conceptual art in which he participated, he was the only artist who dared to use colors which were neither black, nor white, nor gray. Going against the grain of the serious, that is a black and white look of conceptual art, Buren always used color in contestation. For him, as he has recently confirmed, color is an eminently visual, indescribable property, and as such, irreducible to language. Nevertheless, I would like to say a few words about one of Buren's pieces, conceived in 1975 and realized 2 years later, which is sometimes visible using the telescope on the Centre Georges Pompidou terrace in Paris. It is called Les Couleurs Sculpture. The work put in view five drapes mounted in such diverse buildings of the capital as the Louvre, the Samaritan, and some private house. It's the Grand Palais, a private house. Oh, sorry. Its title, Les Couleurs, explicitly refers to the fact that the color also designates, both in French and in English, the national flags. And an homage to Marcel Bruter, a friend of Daniel, fémur of a Belgian man. In 2003, a young French artist, Nina Esber, reworked this clash of meaning when she created a sort of geographic repertoire merging the different colored zones of national flags into panels of single colors. And Russia, France, and United States. Historical conceptual art, to put it euphemistically, sorry for my accent, very horrible accent, has a privileged relationship with ideas inseparably linked to language. Art, according to Joseph Kossuth, is a definition of art. John Baldessari, everything is purged from this painting, but art, no ideas have entered this work. A painting executed between 1966 and 1968, in block letters by the same painter, emblematized this position and at the same time implicitly criticized the already existing ideology of conceptual art appearing in Kossuth's works. What confronted the question of color directly where Kossuth's tautological proposition is a large photograph of color, definition taken from the dictionary, or those neon pieces whose form represent their linguistic content, for example, the 1966 four-color sentence. The linguistic approach of the work, officially inspired by Wittgenstein's remarks on color, take us to a territory which often notoriously haunts the so-called conceptual strategy of art, namely literature and humor. From the description of the Israelite crossing the Red Sea by the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, in which a wall painted red all over indicates that the Israelite had already crossed over while the Egyptians were drowned, to Tarfas, described in a short story by Borges and Joy Casares as a painter of cityscapes who covers his painting with shoe polish, to the black chapter in Laurent Stern's Tristan Shandy. You made an homage, John, to Laurent Stern, I remember. We have abundant literary reference to an absurd and comic vision of monochrome painting. it seems impossible here not to recall the tradition of parodic monochromes, which inscribed into practice of late 19th century literary anarchism, are best represented by Alphonse Allais' contribution to the 1880 Parisian exhibition titled Art Incohérent. How could we recognize in Mel Ramsden's secret painting of 1967 a black square embellished with a framed caption of the same size stating that the content of this painting is invisible, the character and dimension of the content are to be kept permanently secret, known only to the artist. The tacit phantom of Alphonse Allais, black monochrome, Negroes fighting in a cave by night, in his album Primo Avrilesque of 1997. 18, sorry. Allais presented other humor, no, in his album Primo Avrilesque from 1897, Allais presented other humorous monochrome as well, just for the delight of it. The white version was called Anemic Young Girls Going to Their First Communion Through a Blizzard. The yellow bore the title Manipulation of Ochre by Jaudicide Cuckolds, and the red was labeled Apoplectic Cardinals Harvesting Tomatoes by the Red Sea. Yves Klein, and the piece is in the show, at least officially had no sense of humor, had to remember at least subconsciously his self-published booklet titled Yves Peinture, a small landscape format album printed in 1954 while he was teaching judo in Madrid. The 10 places of the booklet, which presumably reproduces painting, are comprised of 10 rectangles of colored paper with legend underneath indicating the name of the author, the place, the date, as well as the dimension of the work. In each copy of the book, the typed in rectangle appears haphazardly, and arranged rectangle supposedly reproducing the Madrid, Paris, the same, but another color. It's time to conclude. The title of this evening's discussion is Color and Conceptualism. Through a few examples taken from the multitude of work involved with color beyond the imposition of absolute or transcendental figures, my contribution has simply been to make exist two words which resonate with the same intensity in English and in French, color and humor. As a dessert, some picture of the Mickey adventure in the Museum of Modern Art. Sorry, I have only found a French version. I love. Look at this canvas. It is not genial. I agree. I'm sure that the artist exprimed what he felt. Ah. He does have confused ideas. Thank you very much.
Bernard, I'll let you start off as the last to speak at the podium.
Yes, because I'm sorry for my very bad English. Sorry, but John Baldessari and Daniel Bernard are not conceptual artists. That's the first point. It was very important for me to. And perhaps.
You know what?
Yes.
Robert Barry said about that.
No.
Were you there? We were in Barcelona, right? We had a whole panel, and he said, I don't mind being called a conceptual artist. It gets me into a lot of exhibitions.
Sure. What? You are not a conceptual artist.
No, I
you
mean...
Are, you were in a lot of exhibition of conceptual art, but you have something to...
No, it all depends what people are making under this term, you know. So it can be yes or no.
No, I mean, it's conceptual, in fact. No,
the fact is, I did participate, like I think John as well, to all these exhibitions since the very first one in '69. And at the very first one, I put a long text to immediately said why I was being very suspicious about the term conceptual art. So, you know, I wrote about that a lot, so I'm not really in a mood to speak again about these problems. But, of course, I did participate, taking my own space, knowing that the term itself was extremely ambiguous. And, of course, like any kind of classification will be possibly used by some people against the others. So this is even deeper than the idea of concept and art and all these. It's as soon as you have a school name or whatsoever, which become like a grouping. And don't forget that when we started with this first exhibition, it was something like 90 artists. Oh. And just to give an idea of what I mean by the suspicious attitude in front of such a grouping, it's the fact that, not to make a polemic, but today, conceptual art, there are more or less 5 American artists, and that's it.
Well, I've got a couple of things to say about it. I remember in the early days, Joseph was thinking that, well, maybe it's too loose a term, and that, you know, that the real serious conceptual artist, you know, maybe. And Douglas Huebler said, well, tell me, you know, like it's radical conceptual artists. And so Doug said, well, do you want to call it Radicon? And that was the end of that conversation. But in terms of these isms, I don't know, how many, if I asked you to list Impressionist artists, what do? You start with Monet and then you kind of, well, I don't know. But they're all sort of useful at the beginning as baskets for writers to group people in, you know, and then after that, you know, they go off into whatever they're doing. An old friend of my, well, two old friends, Klaus Oldenburg and both Roy Lichtenstein, both, you know, just made gaffes and said something about Klaus about being a pop artist. He said, I'm not a pop artist. And Roy Lichtenstein, the same thing. He said, I'm not a pop artist. So as you go on, you develop who, you know, you become just who you are, what you do. But it's a term, you know, journalists like to use when they sense something that's afoot.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little less clear for me, maybe, with you, John, than with you, Daniel, if using the color in your work at the outset in the early 70s, say, was something that the conceptual circle of artists made, that this made them uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, I picked up on that. Black, white, and gray, that meant you were serious, you know, and conceptual art was serious. And Peter Sheldahl, some years back, he got it right on. I guess there was MoCA, right? Yeah, showing conceptual art. And Peter wrote a review of it. And he said, nobody realized back then what great decorators conceptual artists were.
Right.
But to come back to what Bernard said, it was really striking in this period, more or less all the 70s, to see all exhibition being more or less black and white, yeah, or monochromatic.
Yeah. Funny.
Absolutely, yeah. Completely. And it's really true that to dare, to put something colored or with color was immediately seen as something decorative, weak, uninteresting, etc., etc. So time changed. But that was really a fantastic academy of black and white artists.
Yeah, and Dibitz told me a great story about wanting to do for an exhibition catalog at that time a color reproduction for his section. And the curator just wouldn't let him have a color reproduction in the book because none of the artists could have, it was all black and white. And Jan's photograph, he said, just had to be in color. So finally he negotiated with the curator that he would have a color plate, but that absolutely had to promise not to tell any of the artists, and until the book appeared, no one would know that there was going to be this one color plate in the book for this one artist, because it was just simply unacceptable.
You know, I think it was a plot. It was very simple. It was printing costs were cheaper,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's why.
Very lofty reasoning. But there's no question that you've both become, over especially the last decade, real celebrants of color. And this is something that was paralleled in other artists, like most obviously that one sees in the exhibition, Flavin and Judd, Saul LeWitt as well, in the last decade. And what do you think are the reasons that has come about?
Well, I can talk for myself first, okay. I got to say, when I first saw the colored Judds, I was just shocked. What is he doing? You can't do this. But he did. I think for myself was that what brought it into focus for me was going into photography, and I think I alluded to it, that if you're painting, you can do anything. It's just a white surface, and you want blacks, black, white, whatever. You can do anything. Photograph, you have to deal with what's out there. So, I couldn't stand that, as you see. And then I actually began painting on the photograph just because I couldn't stand what I was seeing. There was another reason too, that I wish I had said, but somebody else said it, that all photographs look the same because they're just all the same surface. And so I wanted to change the reflectivity of it, and paint will do that. But then if I were going to then begin painting, why would I replicate something in the photograph? I mean, that would be kind of boring. If there's a fence there, why should I continue with a blue fence? Just do something else. And instead of something, just pure color. Why not pure color? So that got me off in that direction. And then I began to use color as pure signal, just like wires, electric wires, red for that wire, green for that wire, and so on. It's not about beautiful wire. And I think when you start thinking about that way, then it's just pure color. Why mix color? Deal with what's out there, and if you're going to deal with pure primaries and secondaries, they're not usually muted. It's not like forest green or sky blue. So I began, and then also I've got to say Matisse has always been a hero of mine, because he, I guess, and Giotto were my two big heroes, because they made art look so simple but so profound at the same time. I think there's a lot of Matisse in me. I think it's a great way to get people's attention. to get them to look. Traffic lights, people, red light gets your attention, green light is not so, attention gathering, that sort of thing. And if the average length of looking at art in a museum is, what is it down now, to 7 seconds or something like that?
Oh, 30 seconds.
It keeps on going down.
Yeah.
So you really, don't have much of a chance, do you? So, I mean, you've got to get their attention to say, you know, wait a minute, look at me maybe for a few more seconds, if that's going to happen. Yeah.
More on Matisse, maybe.
I, of course, I use this painting for good reason. But for myself, I think from the very beginning, and I took a few years before I really dared to use it because I think it's one of the most difficult topic. But I always thought that color in the art field is the most absolutely pure reflection of any thought. In other words, you cannot describe color. And in his way, paradoxically, John, in some of the pieces he shows, is more or less saying the same thing. You know, you can set blue and you put the pink just next to it, etc. You can even go to this extent. The words, which is also very interesting, the words for colors can be hundreds, and their signification is absolutely meaningless. Yeah. Plus the fact that we know that we don't exactly know if somebody else is seeing the same color as we do. But I think color is a pure thought, and I think I don't even understand how in the field of visual, which can be, you know, touched by many, many, many ways, color, at least for a long period, was more or less rejected by many artists. Yeah. And for me, it's really, it's the most basic thing because no words, no phrase, no description can replace. And it's very few things like that. It's very few elements in many different fields where you really have something which is like that. Especially because for communication or whatsoever, we all use language. And so the language is really dominating in most of the...
Well, I think it also it's kind of fun, you know, just like, what will happen if I do this? Will God strike me dead if I use pure color? And you take, and you do it and nothing happens. So it's fine.
The bridge stays up in Bilbao and... But you, I spoke to you a bit in Paris, Danielle, about how in the 60s you had a great dislike for Matisse. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yes, I mean, I still have.
40 years later.
No, I mean, you know, it's again the same thing with as soon as you touch almost anything in the art world, and I guess in any kind of field. When we said Matisse, first of all, it's like color. You know, I don't know which Matisse you speak about. Mm-hmm. So it's hundreds of, easily hundreds of different type of works done by Matisse. So when we said we dislike or we like somebody like that and we take the name, I think it's really superficial. Unless you really hate everything from someone, and then it's easy to say, forget it, it doesn't exist for me. But with Matisse, I think it's a fantastic artist, and maybe that is even make him, which I can now maybe understand better than when I was 20 years old, it's a great artist who has also huge holes of bad works. Yeah. And so when I said, when I was 20, 25, Matisse was something I was really impossible to stand, I was obviously thinking about these hundreds of naked women and stupidity he produced for so many, many years. And of course, in the middle even of this production, you have a masterpiece all of a sudden. And for me, you have the very beginning of his career with the dance or the music, and especially all the paper cut, which are certainly one of the most fantastic things done in the 20th century. So, you know, you have this kind of extreme unbalanced possibilities to see to Matisse. So if I said I really admire Matisse, I can even mention the paintings I like. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And that, maybe it's clearer because you can see to what I refer. But Matisse, like that in general, it's very, very tricky to use, more than some people. For example, I will have much less problem to say I like or I dislike Mondrian, because I don't see in Mondrian many big, poor works, etc. It's something with a kind of density all the time.
And with Duchamp, my dear Daniel, that's a problem, because the show is with Duchamp. The emblem of the show is a tomb. Tu m'emmerdes, you are. It's perhaps a painting, perhaps a, what's your position? You change your mind with Duchamp too? Because I remember you do prefer Picabia to Duchamp, and now.
At the one same point, yes.
Yes.
No, but that's, again, it's really even more complex, but that's the same thing as Matisse. You know, Duchamp, even if he produced much, much less than someone like Matisse or Picasso or these people, what he did was almost each time absolutely like a crystal. And depending what you take, it's not the same artist. So you perfectly know that I am never accepted the interest of the ready-made.
Yes, I know.
But that's only one thing about Matisse, maybe the most famous. But it's not what I feel the most...
You have a sentence about it, about the pissotière. Yes, it's a very good sentence.
I don't remember. But
no, I'm a very close friend with the most famous dermatologist in Beverly Hills. And I was, first I was thinking, well, you know, we're all ready-mades. But I said, no, in Beverly Hills, we have assisted ready-mades.
Did you see the Duchamp show in 1963?
I did, yes.
Yeah?
We were just talking. I was too timid to talk to him, but, I saw it, sure.
And how did the exhibition hit you at that time?
Well, it was nice actually seeing the work rather than just photograph some of the thing. That's always been a big point of mine certainly in teaching. Like students that have never seen Mondrian have seen a photograph, so they're doing Mondrians with tape, right? And then if you ever see a Mondrian, you know it's just they're painted, you know. So I feel sorry for students that don't get to see real art, you know, whether they're not in a big city with museums, because they get a really weird idea of what the work is. But there's a good fallout. A lot of times those weird ideas turn out to be pretty good pieces of work, because it's not a Mondrian, but a Mondrian misunderstood.
In the audience. Yeah.
It's interesting to hear Monsieur Buren's comments about color and Matisse, because a few years back when you had your retrospective at the Pompidou, which I thought was spectacular, and
which was not a retrospective.
Small blemish in my argument, but at the end of the show, when everyone was leaving, a very, very fine French writer, Bernard Blestin, was walking out with a huge, jovial smile on his face, arm in arm with the great French architect, Jean Nouvel, the two of them obviously very happy with your show. And I asked Bernard, you were pleased? And he said, he is the new Matisse. He is the new Matisse. We have finally found him. And I said, you're comparing him to Matisse? And he said, we haven't had anyone in France for 100 years who've understood color as much as Matisse. But now we have.
Not a question.
Question about the sources of your colors, about obviously they're found, but you, in some of the images that you showed, you kind of cycled through a series of colors, and it seemed to be a progression. So I was wondering if you could tell more about the relationship between, especially in some of the colors, for example, the pieces that are situated just on the shore of the lake or the river that you showed at the end, kind of how one relates to the next from beginning to end of the series.
You mean from one work to another?
Within a work, when there's multiple colors, how you kind of calculate the relationships between them.
I always try to, as I said, when it's more than two colors, they are always made in a way where, let's say, my own taste is not involved. So I take, for example, the alphabetical order which is given by the colors I choose or by the alphabetical order anyhow of the place where the works are visible. So that's one thing. Many, many times when people are open to do that, I ask other people to make the choice. And I did that a lot at the beginning because I think it was a very good exercise to fight against myself. Because if not, you, everyone, even any one of you, have a tendency to like some colors more than others, etc. And I never get in front of colors with this idea. I think it's, at least for me, it's completely wrong. But I have also certainly a certain affiliation or taste with some colors. So to try to break such a tendency, which can be good or bad, this is not the problem, I often find some artificial way to make the choice. Sometimes, but that is for some, I would say, very specific reason, more like even to make the thing existing, I make a choice, and usually it's one color. And just to give an example, but funny enough, it's an example where the work was white on white. I did, for the Documenta in 72, I did a work which was done with the, of course, the help of the organizer, was done before the arrival of the artist. So when all the museum is painted white, and then you arrive and you can show your work. So I put my place with the painters. And so I covered several walls in the full Documenta with the paper, which was specially printed white, quasi-white on white. And, of course, I was having, let's say, a room with different people where I was installed with a work of mine between, I think, Bob Bryman, Bryce Marden, and Richard Long, so a very nice white wall, white room, for showing, let's say, my work as a piece. And, of course, if I use the white on white, it's because I knew to make it working, it should be not immediately visible. And the different artists or the people who were installing put the work of the people on all the other section, and of course on top of my wall as well as the white wall. So the discussion or the dialectic was given by, is this work is a work of art in the room where it's supposedly works of art exhibited, or it's a decoration for other works, or it's just a background for whatsoever. And immediately you can imagine that if I was doing black and white stripes, it will have been totally impossible because no one will have even put his work on top of such a thing, too strong, too visible. So they were sometime embarrassed by the thing, but when they discover that it was something behind. But that was another story, and really sometimes after the fact. But that's just to give an idea. And so, like, for example, the last piece I show, at the and in Bilbao, I really make a choice between the material and the full situation of the color. For many reasons, but they are really objective in a way. For example, the bridge, in one way, when you go out of the city, it's just behind, in front of a mountain and hills. So it's totally green. So that excludes automatically the green, unless you want to do something which is not visible. So you have a lot of choice to do like that. You want to do something invisible, so you try to make the thing in accordance to that. You want to do something which can be immediately visible, then you have to take care, like in this way, of the background. And then the material which you work with will give also a lot of indication, because like for the thing in Bilbao, you know, the material, the choice of color was extremely reduced, like I think 5 or 6 different colors. So you have all these parameters and you work with. But I work always like that instead of saying, I want that. You know, I want what is it. I want what I can find, and I want something which is under the possibilities. So it's very different, even if the result might look sometimes similar, but it's very different as to do a work with all your genius and to finally do, for example, the Red Studio by Matisse, which is one of his absolutely fabulous painting. And then you really see that he makes a choice of all these reds. And that's really a different approach, completely opposite.
And something I just thought of, I don't know if it holds up, but I'll put it out there. The period of the abstract expressionists, big paintings and using house paints, and I guess that coming out of the Mexican muralists like Siqueiros, yes, and Orozco, using auto lacquers and so on and mixing, you know. But I think that probably was the break, wasn't it? I mean, where you begin to consider colors that are not bought in an art store.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. That's kind of pivot point.
Yeah.
Definitely. One last question. Yeah.
Sorry. Somebody there.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about emotional responses to color and how that intersects with color as conceptual.
I need to catch.
How the connection between conceptual color and the emotional side of color.
You know, you cannot, what I said, it's for myself when I work. But I know perfectly that as soon as you use color, which I think is maybe one of the reasons at one point only a kind of monochrome or reduce, let's say, idea of color with black and gray or gray and white or whatsoever as being used so much, is because even if you don't want, what you give to see has a portion and maybe a big portion of emotion. So the problem is not to completely be out of that. The problem is just to know the existence of such a thing. And knowing this existence, it's, for example, one of the reasons I can put the same works, let's say, if it's possible, but theoretically it's possible, in Germany, in France, and in England, and in Japan, and they will be in a very different order. So they will look very different. And so everyone with this feeling will have a very different approach. Sometimes they will maybe like the arrangement, sometimes they will absolutely dislike. And this is part of the result, but it's not part of my own taste or emotion. But I will never deny that someone can have a strong and deep emotion with the way to use colors, even if the way to use it is not to provoke this emotion. But it's there. It's like to try to say everything I am doing has nothing to do with aesthetic or with beauty. You can always say that. But in the result, it's not true.
Well,
you know, all the 20th century, and we know that, of course, very well, all the artists never took care of, let's say, beauty, to speak about beauty. But you don't have any of these people speaking about the 50 biggest of all tendency being mixed. No one of these did not make something which is absolutely beautiful. But they all start saying this is outside of us, doesn't exist.
One person I was thinking of.
But it's not true, that's all. It's just a result which is different.
An artist I was thinking of in particular who tends to cross those boundaries a little bit is Spencer Finch, who's making very kind of emotional and romantic kinds of work, but making the work in such a way where it also can be read in a conceptual way and a kind of organizing it in a way where he's organizing color.
My cynical self, I often thought this. We all, that group of artists that we were all part of, try to escape our own good taste. That was kind of a benchmark sort of thing. So then I got thinking, now, wait a minute. So if you make up the rules in advance, then it's non-aesthetic. If you make up, you do the painting and you make up the rules afterwards, then it's aesthetic. You can see what I'm getting at.
That's it.
You can flip it.
Yeah.
The more you know, it's like trying to, you know, to get the blood off your hands out, you know, Shakespeare. You know, the more you try to get rid of it, the more it's there.
That's great. Okay, we leave you with that. Thank you very much to our speakers, and thank you to the audience.